I don't give a fuck if you wear a sombrero, but people have a right to critique you for being a fuckwit with it.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. Opposite me is my co-host, Ian Mon. Hello, Ian.
Good morning.
It is. It's a Sunday morning.
Yes. How are you?
Tired. I had a late night.
I had a late night too, and yet I got here on time.
Yeah, I'm on time. I'm tired. You asked me how I was. I'm tired.
So what's a late night for you, 9:30?
2 o'clock.
Is this because of the train coming back?
No, with the drive back from Melbourne, yeah. We were playing D&D. So it was an early finish, actually, because I had to get home for the podcast. We often stay overnight and don't finish till about...
So you're blaming me for your truncated D&D session?
No, it wasn't truncated because we started early. It's all fine. We don't need to talk about D&D. That was a good game. I died, good. And then I came back.
So what's happened in the last month?
Nothing much.
Apparently there was a Brisbane Writers Festival.
Do we need to talk about Lionel?
Well, you said that because we'd reviewed her book.
Well, no, we did. We did review.
She's now
Winnie
apparently. We now apparently own her.
She's one of our stable.
Yeah. She
No, it's not just because we reviewed her book, but you know, the authors who we review, I do kind of, they attract my attention a bit more than I guess.
I will say this: there's a whole lot of people across the world who now know of a place called Brisbane.
That's true, or Brisbane, as the Americans, Brisbane.
Yeah, so now aware of this place.
Yeah.
North of where you used to live.
Yeah, quite a bit north of where I used to live. Although my current husband is from Brisbane, and my previous two significant partners were both from Brisbane too. So it's something.
What is that?
Brisbane-y
say?
Happening. It's weird. It's very weird. I don't like Brisbane in summer. So I would not. You know.
Well, you are in one of the coldest places in Victoria. So.
We pretty much are. We had a very cold, wet winter.
Yes.
Anyway,
let others do weather. Anyway, so let's the elephant in the room. We don't normally talk about current issues because by the time people listen to this or many years later, they're not current anymore. So we're not.
Yeah, but this has been a recurring kind of conversation we've been having over the years.
Yes.
With various books we've looked at and just. Our general interests, I guess. So Lionel Shriver, for those of you, this very small sliver of the Venn diagram who listen to our podcast but have not heard about Lionel Shriver's keynote speech at the Brisbane Writers Festival earlier this month. She basically gave it was rude is what it was, because she was asked as keynote and invited and flown over to be keynote speaker for Brisbane and asked to talk on community and belonging, which was the theme of the festival. So in the first place, it's just kind of rude to essentially say, well, fuck that. I don't want to talk about it. I'm talking about this.
Yeah, but my only issue is the Brisbane Writer Festival must have known. I mean, Shriver's not been quiet about these sort of issues in the past.
Yeah.
I mean, she has strong political views. She calls herself in the speech an iconoclast, which is an overused.
Renowned iconoclast.
Exactly. Well, so renowned that they sort of gave her this
carrot
run with.
I guess it's like she looked at it as permission, but I still think it's impolite.
Well, she's talking about the community of authors. Who are being destroyed by cultural appropriation.
A community of white Western authors.
Mostly. Well, let's not generalise.
That's what she was talking about.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
All the names she drops, yes, and true. That's who she was talking about. She was talking about the poor, maligned, marginalised, silenced community of white Western authors who can no longer write everything they want to write the way they want to write it.
Correct. Which is bullshit. But let's not jump. And we're not going to repeat what others have said.
No, there's been a lot of commentary on this
by
some very smart people, and I will provide a whole bunch of links
and
that I've come across.
You'll also provide a link, I hope, to the Australian Financial Review article.
Do I have to?
Yes, because I think it's always good to have a contrary view.
So there was an article recently in the Australian Financial Review, which is a conservative paper, I think you could classify it as. by
Joe Aston,
which was just a terrible article. He had nothing new to actually.
Can I just read the first paragraph before we get into this? Just to set the tone of this article.
Sure.
But I'm not going to speak any more about it. But he goes, Brisbane has a writers' festival. Who knew? Yes, I'm maybe putting a bit of tone on this. The outlier's enduring yearning and failure to present as avant-garde, a doomed enterprise. After all, a writers' festival would surely require geographic proximity to a catchment of people who can read. That's the first paragraph.
Yeah,
fuck you, Brisbane, says Joe Aston. You guys can't read. You're all illiterate.
So, anyways, I'll link to it if you want me to.
No, please do.
I don't see the point because he basically he kind of rehashes what Lionel Shriver said, says nothing new, and spends half the article making ad hominem attacks on Yassim Abdul-Magyad and Yenrin Wong.
Well, I've talked about it now on the podcast. So you'll have to link to
about
it.
The fact that they're not as successful in his eye. Well, probably in an objective way.
Well, he pokes fun at the fact.
And therefore, their arguments are invalid is kind of the whole.
He pokes fun at their success or lack thereof.
Yeah. Yes. And by implication, and that's his rebuttal to them. You're not as successful as Lionel Shriver. Subtext, you're just jealous. Subtext, your arguments are invalid. It was a ridiculous article, but if you want me to link to it, I'll link to it. But I will also link to much more substantial critique and commentary on what Shriver actually
and
said.
And his speech.
And his speech, of course. Yeah, so just commentary about cultural appropriation in general and the mechanics and all of this sort of stuff.
Because the given is that we believe in cultural appropriation.
Well, we believe it's a thing.
It's a thing, yes.
We don't believe in going out and tally-ho, let's appropriate.
So what we don't believe, I just want to make it clear, is that identity politics is evil.
Or non-existent.
Or non-existent.
As Shriver said. She does not believe that identity.
We don't believe that identity politics has been used by a certain area of the left to marginalise Marxists' view of the left and be a cover for what is the real problem, which is class. So identity politics.
Not that Shriver said any of that.
No, but I'm just making it clear where
yes.
we stand.
Mm-hmm.
Or from the right perspective, which is more, and the new alt-right perspective, which is you wouldn't have identity politics if all the people living in your country were white.
That
is the argument.
The argument holds water in that, and I think Shriver's speech is a really good example of it because in part of her speech she talks about how Chinese is not an identity, gay is not an identity, and it illustrates that if you are in or perceive yourself to be in a monoculture. Yes, there would be no such thing as identity politics. If everyone has the same identity, broadly speaking, there is no need for politics around the subject of identity. It doesn't mean that identity doesn't exist. It doesn't mean you don't have a sense of yourself based on, your physical attributes, your cultural attributes and all of that stuff. It's just that if everyone is like you, there's no need to butt heads on it. So,
there's still identity.
Yes, the fact
at the very minimum, the rural versus city. Identities, which are different.
Yeah, but I mean, this is what Shriver is sort of illustrating, I think, in quite a fascinating way. There's so many points where you sit back and go, do you realise what you're saying there? Because she very much has her own identity. But because it's the dominant cultural identity, she can put it aside and say, well, identity doesn't exist.
Yeah, but...
Because there's that part where she talks about her novel, The Mandibles, which, I mean, full disclosure, I've not read it. But based on her own words, she talks about how she received a critique from one reviewer saying it was all about white people, blah, 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 blah. I don't know what that review was.
Let me be clear. It was all about white people and the only black person is a woman who is married to the 97-year-old octogenarian who Shriver says marries this woman because he wanted to show off to all his liberal friends. So,
yes.
And then ultimately there's this wonderful – and this is all Shriver. I'm not making this shit up. This is wonderful because it's set in the future. It's a it becomes a dystopia. Wonderful twist where the black woman gets dementia, Alzheimer's, and – starts running off, so they have to put her on a leash to keep her, protect her.
Yeah.
But the woman that the 97-year-old left for the black woman, she becomes the head scientist, whatever, of an institute dealing with Alzheimer's or dementia.
Dementia research.
Correct. Yeah. Isn't that just a wonderful...
Well, and here's the issue. So there's that, but what I was saying was when she's talking about the book, she's saying, and I'll find the exact quote because I don't want to misquote
you're
her.
You're just going to undermine everything I just
said. No, it's exactly the same thing, right? She says, she's writing a multi-generational, it's, so what Shriver says is that it happens that this, referring to the mandibles, that this is a multi-generational family saga about a white family. I wasn't instinctively inclined to insert a transvestite or bisexual with issues that might distract from my central subject matter of apocalyptic economics. And that, like, that's this perfect little encapsulation of the mechanics of the dominant cultural group. The idea that if you include a character who's not a straight white cis character, then all of anything around that character is by necessity bound up with whatever identity is, I guess, central to them. So if they're trans or if they're bisexual or if they're black or if whatever it is, that story has to be about that. And so having one of those characters will distract from your central narrative.
They distort the narrative.
Which is ridiculous, but it shows, in Shriver's own words, that identity politics is real.
Yeah.
She didn't want to use a character with what she perceives as a political identity because that political identity would detract from the core of her narrative. If that isn't underlying the validity of identity politics, I don't know what is. And she's made that case herself.
But it's more than that. She wanted a character who, you're right, exactly what you've just said, but she also wanted a character who could be a cut and paste version of a black person.
Well, yeah.
Because she didn't want to get into any of that stuff. So she's picked a, and again, the character, this we have not read the novel.
No.
But even on her own words, this character is essentially a plot MacGuffin.
Well, can I read her own words? Because this is what made me another point in her speech where I sat up and went, do you know what you're saying? Because what you said about the main patriarch character, I guess, who leaves his white wife for an African American woman, because that's a thing that apparently if you're a Democrat you do, according to Shriver. And then she says, but in the end, the joke is on Douglas, because Luella suffers from early onset dementia while his ex-wife, staunchly of sound mind, ends up running a charity for dementia research. So she's using this black woman
as part of a punchline to a joke.
With a disability, literally as a joke.
I know. That's
she's
right.
There as a joke. She's there to be the joke. She's not there
to be. Let's divorce the fact. I know it might be controversial. Let's divorce the fact that Luella is a person of colour. Let's divorce that. Just even if she was just vanilla. this is treacherous land I'm getting into here.
Yes.
It's still bad writing because you've created a character simply for a punchline.
And look, to be fair, we haven't read the book. She might be an incredibly...
She says it herself.
This is just going by... So the character in the book, she might be an incredibly well-rounded character with lots of depth and whatever. But what Shriver is saying illustrates the mechanics of how she constructed her fiction.
Okay, but let's take Shriver's word. Yeah. Let's take Shriver's word.
Yeah.
If then a reviewer comes along and critiques a character, black or otherwise, because... In the view of the reviewer, that character is simply being used as a punchline, that they have no internal life of their own. That's all they are.
That's all they're there for.
A thing that we point out a lot in the books that we talk about, and you may even point out today, I get the feeling. if that's the case, then that's just shit writing.
Yeah.
And deserves to be critiqued and not then be told, people are trying to ban me. They're trying to ban my voice. That's just crap.
Yeah.
Because the ultimate endpoint of that speech, put cultural appropriation aside, the ultimate endpoint is the opposite of what she's actually she's actively saying, I as a writer should be able to do what the fuck I like. But if someone comes and critiques me, there are rules.
There are rules.
You can't critique me on the appropriation thing because
you can't,
that's a fad, which hopefully will one day go away. You can't critique me on how I use my characters because they're my characters and I can use them however the fuck I want.
Yes.
You can't critique me on my – and then next – so we shouldn't critique anyone anymore. We should stop this podcast because we might upset the writer
I'm sure we have.
We might upset the writer who wants to write about anything. And never, ever. I mean, there's shit reviewers, don't get me wrong, but it's a two-way street.
It is a two-way street. And that's the thing that I kind of want to talk about.
Didn't I just talk about it then? You don't have to talk
about it. No, the two-way street, right? Because there is a part of Shriver's speech where she talks about the importance of cultural exchange And it is important. It is important that cultures and people within cultures aren't cordoned off from each other.
Correct.
And that humans do share things, and they share knowledge, and they share experience. And that I agree with her. That's absolutely vital. But she's missing the key word there, which is exchange. It's exchange, which implies things that are freely given, not things you take because you want them. And that's the difference. And throughout her speech and arguments that I've heard others made along these lines, that is what is conflated. The difference between cultural appropriation, which is just taking stuff because you want it and you can, without a lot of respect for the culture.
Or acknowledging where it comes from.
Or acknowledgement where it comes from. And often against the wishes of that culture, as we saw in the recent J.K. Rowling case with her North American magic stuff.
Yeah.
That goes against the spirit of exchange. Exchange is an intermingling of culture. Exchange is I give you this, you give me that. It's not appropriative. It's not colonial. You know, what Shriver's talking about is absolutely colonial. I want that thing. I want that thing, and I can have that thing, and I have the power to have that thing because of where I sit in the world. Whereas you, who have that thing, don't have the power. You don't even have the power to write about it. If you do have the power to write about it, you certainly don't have the power to get it published. It's about whose voices are allowed to be heard. It's not about who is allowed to write what. Everybody's allowed to write anything they want. We know that. It's about who is allowed to be heard.
I understand that, but the view is, though, that we're past all that. We're clearly not. We had the civil rights movement. We've had, there's more or less free movement of trade, free movement of people. Well, yeah, anyway. and you know, there's an Indian, Chinese and Sri Lankan restaurant around the corner, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, so to get upset with a white writer or whatever for appropriating a culture is silly because this is not colonialism anymore. There are no empires going around, I'm being
devil's advocate. I know.
There are no empires going around taking over other people's cultures. This is just a writer doing what they do.
Yeah, which is interesting. And I like, that's irony. I like the argument about how the age of imperialism is over. And sure, certainly we don't have a large scale geographic endeavor of empire in terms of one nation annexing another nation and physically exploiting its peoples. We don't have that. But, Ian, of all the movies and TV shows you consumed in the past year, what was the percentage of them that were Australian, do you think?
Yeah, near fuck all.
Exactly. We don't have geographic empire to the extent that we did in the 19th century, sure. But to deny that cultural imperialism is not a thing is naive at best and obtuse at worst. Of course we have cultural imperialism. Of course we have dominant cultures that override others, and by using similar mechanics that geographic imperialism worked, dominate the cultures that are allowed to be seen and heard. And we absolutely have this, and I don't know how anyone can deny it. It is just so obvious.
Yeah, okay, but let's get to the nub here.
What's the nub?
The nub is Lionel Shriver wants to write books about any character. Should we ban her work?
No.
Should we censor her?
No, and we don't. And no one is being
Mandible's got published.
In the West, no one is being banned or censored for writing.
Oh, well, no, there'll be someone who'll say I had to go get self-published because I used the N-word throughout my book, and no one liked the use of the mainstream the gatekeepers didn't like my use of the N-word, and therefore I had to be self-published. So therefore there is gatekeeping going on, and I can't express myself fully.
Sure. And? But you see what they did there? They got to be self-published. Are they in jail?
No.
There is a difference between what Shriver is talking about, which is not, she's not standing up there saying, I should be allowed to write books filled with racial slurs and offensive caricatures and all of this sort of stuff. She's not actually saying that. I mean, that is another argument to be had, but she's not saying it. All she's talking about is writing across cultures. And again, there's nothing wrong with that intrinsically. And if we had a level playing field, everyone can do whatever everyone wants and everyone gets heard and everyone has the same access. Yeah, but wait a second.
Level playing field aside, again, no one is saying that she can't do what she's doing.
No.
But then no one is saying that we can't critique her for doing what she's doing.
And that's kind of that is, as you say, that's the number of it because you.
And she either needs a thicker skin or recognition of what she's doing.
Because isn't the irony is that she has had many books published. The Mandibles has been published by major publishers. It has, or it certainly will turn up on award shortlists. She has won major awards in publication as a writer. She's clearly in no danger of being shut down or censored or sidelined. And yet she's the one talking about, I can't do this, we can't do this, when clearly she's a living exemplar of that you can do this. And no one is saying, Lionel, you can't, you know.
But she's saying that there are writers out there who now have to self-censor themselves because they want to set a book in Afghanistan or wherever, but they're now scared to because of the backlash that they'll get from the nasty left media and especially colleges and academics who, you know, only make themselves famous by critiquing this sort of stuff.
Sure. And she does make the point herself that she currently feels a bit nervous about writing. I think she specifically mentions black characters.
Yep.
And that's fine. Like, because you've got two things in play here. You've got A, either as seems to be the front story of her speech, you don't care. You just don't care. You don't care and you know, about whether people like what you've done or not. On the basis of identity politics and cultural appropriation, you actually don't care. You think all of that stuff's rubbish. It doesn't even exist. It's some academic, you know, hoo-ha. In which case, why does she care? Why is it so important that she talks against it?
No, she talks against it. Because this made-up thing is ruining the ability for her to write.
But it's clearly not.
Yeah, no, but she said she's nervous now.
Every writer should be nervous. Every writer should be nervous about what they're writing.
Not because the people will come and put them in jail.
But no one is coming to put her in jail.
But because they should, no, I'm saying they should be nervous because whether you're writing something from your own perspective or from a marginalised perspective or whatever.
Yeah.
A work, once it goes out there, is going to be critiqued positively and negatively.
Absolutely. And that's like every book is subject to that or has the potential to be subject to that because, yeah, if no one knows about the book, no one's going to critique it. And so
But the thing is, when Mandibles came out, it got some of these reviews.
Yeah.
Okay. But there was no Twitter war about Mandibles.
No.
There was no Facebook war or social media war. In fact,
there were no calls to ban it. There were no calls to pull it from libraries.
She did a couple of reviews for the cultural appropriate or for the tokenistic use of one of her characters. But, again, you know, no one was going on. I knew about the book because my Goodreads popped up on my Goodreads because I'd read her
previous book. A book you've read has published another book, yes.
It's come and gone.
Yes. I mean, she
And a lot of these books that she's talking about didn't spark a flame war when they were published.
No.
They were critiqued.
Yeah.
But
and that is the big difference.
So where's the ego here?
Between what she's talking about, which is that writers are systemically prevented from writing about cultures and identities different from their own, which is in the case of being a white Western writer, is absolutely absolutely not the case. However,
yeah.
It is sometimes the case when you are a writer who is not a white Western, often male, often heterosexual cis writer, because then you are actually often pigeonholed into writing only about your identity.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that's what we want to hear from you. Oh, you're a black Muslim woman. That's what we want to hear from you. We don't want to hear other things. We want to hear about your identity, and your stories about your identity need to fit the palatable narrative.
Yeah, there's this great article from last year that I can't remember who wrote it about how books written by people from African descent or African culture, how the blurbs really focus on all that. Oh, so this is about the troubles in Africa and class.
And transcending the...
Whereas just a normal literary writer of white descent doesn't get... This is the answer to all the Anglo-Saxon and Caucasian issues of
exactly.
the time.
Exactly. And this is, I think, one of the tragic ironies that underpins Shriver's argument is that she is talking about how she, as a well-published, well-established person who's invited to keynote writers' festivals, white Western woman, is being prevented from writing and publishing what she wants, when this is clearly not the case. Whereas writers from, or writers who have a marginalised identity, are being prevented from doing that, exactly that. Because they're told you can only write about your identity because your identity is the most important thing. As Shriver indicated, you know, if she puts a trans character into a book about apocalyptic economics, oh, that would detract from the apocalyptic economics, as though there could be no trans people living in an apocalyptic economic world, right? It makes me quite angry because she's using arguments of silencing and censorship and chilling, when actually it's another group of people, many groups of people, who are being prevented from writing anything they want and getting it published.
And just to make Shriver feel better about herself, it's not just a critique on white people, because this becomes part of the Donald Trump stump speech, that white people are now being shat upon from everyone, and it's now time for white people to show that, you know, to the backlash, you know, all that
take back the white.
Take back the white. No, I mean, you know, I critique Jewish writers who get the Jewish wrong.
Yeah. And every, like, you can't put a book out into the world, especially at a certain level of exposure, and not get critiqued on stuff. This is part and parcel.
And if you don't like it, ignore
publishing.
It and or...
And you can either ignore it and think those critiques are completely valueless, and some of them are. You know, I've had reviews of books where it's like, did you read my book? It doesn't sound like you read my book. But it, you know, and you just, if you genuinely think that critique has no value, then push it aside. Push it aside. That's what you do all the time. It'd be, I think, more thoughtful if you are getting a number of critiques that run similar lines, that maybe you think about what they're saying. And this is not a bad thing. Like, she uses the word instinctively. She was not instinctively inclined to put a trans character or a bisexual character into a novel about economic apocalypse, because white is the default. So putting white characters in there doesn't detract from that narrative, because that's the default. That's the neutral. It's not neutral. It's anything but neutral. But let's put that aside. She uses the word instinctively. I've come to deeply distrust the idea of writerly instincts and intuition, because they're nothing but what we have accrued over years and years of reading and writing. They're our go-to things, and they feel right and they feel instinctive, and we literally don't have to think about them, which is why they're instinctive. But that's not always an indicator of them being right or true or valid. It's an indicator of what we've been exposed to repeatedly, what we're used to, reading, what we're used to writing. And I think we need, as writers, we need to question and challenge our instincts all the time. You know, this is what I instinctively want to do. Why do I instinctively want to do that? Where does that instinct come from? How has it been informed? And then, is it really the most interesting thing to do for this story that I want to write?
Too much thinking.
This is a writer's job. A writer's job is to think and think and rethink.
She says, if cultural appropriation keeps going the way it is, I'll only be allowed to write memoir. That's all you can write, because I can only write of my personal experience, because any other sort of experience is appropriative in some way.
Rubbish. Rubbish. And no one is saying that. I mean, okay, that's not fair. I'm sure there are some people who might say that. I'm sure there is a fringe group who say exactly that. But the mainstream discourse around cultural appropriation and identity and empowerment and equity and all that sort of stuff is not saying that. What the discourse is saying is that when it supposes that people will write cross-culturally, cross-identity.
I mean, I want diversity in the ensemble cast.
When you do that, you have to do it well, right? It's a degree of difficulty thing. The harder you, the target is that you're doing, the better you have to do it. Because when you fail spectacularly. You know, it's like gymnasts. A really hard routine on gymnastics looks effortless and beautiful and wonderful. But, oh, my God, if they fuck it up, it just looks just deplorable. And that's the harder the thing is that you're doing, the better you have to do it, the more research you have to do it, the more pre-publication critiques you need. And that's for anything. That's not even for cross-cultural stuff. And we know that. We know that as readers. Poor research, faulty logics, all of this stuff stands out. And so cultural things is no different to any of that. And getting critiqued on that basis is no different to getting critiqued on any other basis. It so happens that at the moment it's a very important conversation because, as we've said, the voices that are allowed to be heard, the voices that are given prominence via not just publication but where they're published, the quantities in which they're published, where reviews are presented, award shortlist awards themselves, books that are chosen to be discussed on podcasts, all of this stuff determines the stories that we hear. And one of the arguments that I've got a lot of sympathy for, and I'm still trying to think how that works in the world, is that if it's one thing to say that if for example, if a white writer writes a book about Afghanistan,
yep,
and they research it meticulously and they spend a decade writing it and they put it back and forth with beta readers and they write this wonderful book that's rich and resonant and researched well, and it's a wonderful book, and in this fantasy world no one has any objections to any depictions in the book and it's all wonderful. There's still the problem of it's which voices get heard. So a book written about an Afghanistan family by an Afghani doesn't get published. And if it does get published, it doesn't get heard. And that's a really interesting conversation, that it's one thing to talk about dominant people from dominant cultures writing marginalized characters and marginalized stories and getting those stories heard because of who the writers are, but how much that obscures the stories from those cultures that come directly from those cultures. And I think that's also an issue. I think sometimes you need to sit down and shut up and let someone else speak. Like, I don't know that you get to write every story you want to write. I don't think that you do. I think sometimes you need to let other people speak. And I think I've got no data to back this up, but I suspect that this is a more difficult thing for white women to do because of not because of feminism, but because feminism has quite rightly pointed out the silencing of women broadly. So I think with a lot of white women, we find it difficult to sit down and shut up sometimes, because that's what we're pushing against. We're pushing against being told to sit down and shut up and let the man talk. And we kind of apply that resistance, I think, to any occasion where we're told to sit down and shut up. But sometimes we need to sit down and shut up. And I think when we're looking at, stories and voices that don't belong to us, that might be a case where we need to let other people speak, and not white men who want to jump in and take those stories too. I mean, we need to let other people speak. It's a difficult thing. It's nuanced and it's hard, and it's not something that has an easy answer. But it's a conversation that I think needs to be ongoing, and needs to be ongoing for as long as, which is probably forever, for as long as we have such dramatic, inequity in the world, in all aspects of the world.
Let's move on to the books.
Let's move on to the books.
I think that's a perfect note to end on.
So, our loose theme for this month was a first read reread. So we each picked a book,
yes,
that we had read like years and years, and for my case, it was about 20 years ago. I think.
Mine's around about that too,
and that we remembered really liking, but we hadn't reread since.
Correct,
and that the other person hadn't read at all.
Correct.
So you chose Savage Season by Jo Lansdale,
yes,
and I chose The Pillow Friend by Lisa Tuttle.
Yes.
And I was quite fascinated by both these books for various reasons. So should we do yours first?
Yes.
Okay. So, Ian, why did you pick Savage Season by Jo R. Lansdale?
It was an excuse to reread Savage Season by Jo R. Lansdale because I love the Hap and Leonard stories,
mm-hmm,
but I haven't reread them all yet. I haven't kept up to date with the series and I haven't reread them.
So he's still writing the Happen Letters.
Yeah, he's up to book 9 or 10.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And this one has just been turned into a TV series.
And this one
came out this year.
We should say this was first published in 1990.
Yes.
So it's 26-year-old book. Correct. Now.
So he just got turned into a TV series, although going by the pilot, the TV series, although it focuses mostly on Savage Season, it seems to mix a few of the other books in there as well. But that's neither here nor there.
I can see how it would be quite easy to turn into a TV series.
Yeah, well, there's a lot that goes on in a very short
space. There's a lot of plot and a lot of stuff you can bring to the screen and not a hell of a lot of interiority that you need to try to bring to the screen. Yeah. So
I get the impression you didn't like it.
No, I didn't like it.
I don't understand that.
It made me shelve any regret I might have had about not really reading Joe Lansdale over the years. So that's fine. He's not an author for me, quite clearly. I didn't like it.
Why? Well, it is a podcast where we discuss these things.
I know.
Your response cannot be sigh.
My response is not sigh.
Do you want to say what the book's about?
You have to say what it's about. Or do you want me to read the back? I can read the back.
Yeah, okay.
HarperCollins no longer wanted to change the world. The 60s were dead and gone forever. Survival was enough. Until she came back. Trudy was every man's dream in a tight denim miniskirt. When she whistled, even after all these years, Hap came running. Even if Leonard, Vietnam vet and certified hardhead, Hap's best friend, thought she was as fake as pro wrestling, blonde man poison. And Trudy had a proposition. Easy money, a quick dive into the Sabine River, $500,000 in lost hold-up money, a share out with some good old 60s buddies, donations to the cause of your choice, which in Hap's case was Hap. But then things started to go bad. Very bad indeed.
Yeah, I get the feeling that Trudy is your problem with this novel, but probably not your only problem with
Not my only problem with it.
I mean, she's the femme fatale.
Yeah, I think, overall, it's this hijinks kind of novel is not my cup of tea. I did find I found the characters' responses to the story, especially Leonard, who I read as being a quite canny, cluey sort of a guy. The fact that he didn't once suspect that they were going to get, what's the word?
Betrayed.
It's not even betrayed, it's that. The fact that he didn't once suspect that they were going to get betrayed at the end and the people who had come to them to help them get the money weren't going to just turn around and take all the money. What Lansdale wrote about Leonard, that did not ring true.
So I got the impression that you're right, but...
Because I knew, like, that they're going to get betrayed.
The hoodwinked or whatever.
And it's like Leonard never...
He warns Hap off this whole venture
because
from
of
the very
Trudy,
beginning.
Because of Trudy. It's all Trudy.
Yeah.
Well, Leonard hates Trudy and therefore everything's
but
poisoned.
But he does it.
Right? But he doesn't say, oh, but Leonard, do you really think they're going to share the money? Oh, but Leonard, do you really
think... No, I get the feeling enjoys saying, I told you so.
Yeah, but I just didn't buy. And to be fair, I
also don't think Leonard takes them seriously.
I bounced off this book quite a lot.
I don't think, other than Paco, I don't think he takes Trudy what's his name? The leader of the pack and...
Yeah.
I don't think he takes them seriously as well.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. I don't know. I just thought, yeah, it's a book which just goes along from step to step, and I just didn't find that enjoyable. And I'll fully admit that one of the reasons I probably didn't find it enjoyable is that I never really immersed myself into this book because I just kept bouncing off it from. You can see my copy. I've dog-eared pages, page one is dog-eared.
What are you bouncing off?
Mostly, as you say, the depiction and description around Trudy and what she ends up. She ends up being everything the book says she was, or that Hap, who is the because it's a first person narrative, right? So she ends up the book. Ends up justifying everything pretty much that Hap thinks of, or that Leonard thinks about her, and also that Hap thinks about her.
And she is really the only female character in the whole novel.
Well, apart from the the not mute. She almost, she's almost mute. Does she ever say anything? Hardly. The assassin woman at the end.
Oh, no. She does. She corrects.
You're correct. Yeah, that's right. There's a funny little.
There's this ongoing gag. He can't think of the right word, that's right. She corrects him.
Yeah, Angel. Yeah, the offsider to the big bad guy who comes along, right? So yeah, you've got this, which is this really sort of, I guess, not predictable, but caricaturish depiction of women. These two types of women, right? It's not quite the Madonna and a whore. It's, you know, it's these two types. Like, women are just horrible. Women are awful, and they will kill you. It's what the book is basically saying, and it bears out its own thesis. So
yeah, men aren't great either.
Well, this is what I don't understand. Like all of Hap's, because the language is quite. I find the language. I think I come down on careless, because I'm not sure the book is. Other parts of the book don't lead me to think it's that clever with the language. So I think the language is kind of just a bit careless.
Yeah, you got an example?
So you've got, like, Trudy all the way through is Trudy, and actually Angel too, but mostly Trudy is described in the way of birds or animal, you know, birds mostly. And, you know, women are the characters who are most commonly described or aligned with animals and birds, and it's a way of infantilizing women or making women bestial or both. And Trudy all the way through is described in these terms by Hap, and the fact that she, you know, that comes around to her killing the little sparrow, starling, yes, whatever that the bird was that they found.
Yeah, so we should say Hap and I assume you've read the book, listener.
Yeah,
Hap and Trudy are in a relationship in the '60s. All idealism and mum beans. And at one point they're living together and well, they're married actually, and they save a bird.
I think it's a sparrow. A baby sparrow.
When Hap goes to jail for not basically being a draft dodger, but making a political point of being
deliberately
a draft,
doing it. Yeah. Deliberately going to jail.
He goes to jail. Yep. Trudy ends up, we find out, killing the bird.
Yes, because it was too hard to take care
correct
of. Like it's.
Well, it's a metaphor of their.
It is it is a metaphor.
It's a bit on the nose. I agree.
It is a bit on the nose, right? But so Leonard's perspective of Trudy, and that he says a couple of times, is that she's a whore, right? And then, and this is then backed up because there's a part where Trudy's angry at Hap and they have sex, and the line is something like, you know, she fucked me like I was paying for it. So that reinforces what Leonard said about her. Like the depiction of Trudy and who she is reinforced not just through Hap's perspective, but through the mechanics of the book itself and through the language that Lansdale chooses to use. Which is, you know, a problem for me. I just thought, yeah, Trudy was a ridiculous character. And, I mean, there's things like, because she's in her 40s, right?
Yes.
And there's a line where Hap talks about, like, it's established she has quite big breasts, and then there's another line later in the book where it talks about, oh, and she comes walking towards him in a top that shows him how she still doesn't need to wear a bra. And it's like, I'm sorry, if you're a woman in your 40s, like that has big boobs, that's not going to be an enticing visage coming toward, you know what I mean? Like it's this absence of knowing, and that's not happening. This is the character, this is Lansdale, this is the writing, this is the writing of how this woman looks, right? And it's ridiculous. These things constantly threw me out. And another thing, like let me just read this sentence. And it wasn't the only time he used this phrase, right? Suddenly I felt sorry for Howard, who's Trudy's current husband / sap. Suddenly I felt sorry for Howard. Like me, he didn't have a chance with a gal like Trudy. Not really. She ruled us with brains and passion and her downy triangle. I don't know what type of women Joe Lansdale's familiar with, but I've never come across pubic hair that was downy. Downy is soft. Downy is young birds, right? Birds have down before they fledge.
But it's not an uncommon use by men.
I know, but this is what I'm saying about the carelessness of the language, right? Because that at once infantilizes her, which is really disturbing when you're talking about the genitals of a woman and making them seem like the genitals of a very young girl. Again, not having to wear a bra, what a very young girl. You know, that's also like grown women who don't have large breasts don't have to wear bras. But, you know, like all of the language around her sexuality and her physicality, so much of it skews to young. It's kind of disturbing. Not saying Hap Collins is a pedophile. I'm saying he might skew that way. Because when...
No,
because every time, like when her physicality is mentioned in a bad way, it's because, oh, the sun has fallen on her face and shows her wrinkles. He's so, like, you know, the language around the physical appeal of Trudy is all around her being very young.
Yeah, but perhaps Trudy is a symbol of the 60s.
Sure.
So he remembers her a lot as the woman he knew in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely.
When she may have had
I'm sure she didn't even have it. Like, no, it's never Downy. Like,
I understand.
Not ever going to have Downy pubic hair as a grown woman. Like, this is what I'm talking about, the carelessness of the language. But it's not just Trudy, because I found this absolutely fascinating. I've read it like 5 times. It's the most, possibly the most fascinating paragraph in the whole book, because we should say that Leonard, who's Hap's best friend, is both black and gay.
Yes.
And it's kind of a running joke through the book. And I get that when you're really good friends, you can joke about stuff like that. And that's kind of okay. But there's this one paragraph, and I really don't know, because of the language of the rest of the book and the way it's written, I honestly don't think this is deliberate, but it's fascinating. So Hap comes, walks into the barn, Leonard's barn, and Leonard is working out. He's boxing with a bag. And so here we go. He was stripped to the waist wearing a pair, and this, remember, this is all first person. This is what Hap is seeing. So Leonard was stripped to the waist wearing a pair of grey sweatpants, low-cut tennis shoes with white socks and a pair of worn bag gloves. His face and hard upper torso looked like wet chocolate, and when the light caught him right, the thick beads of sweat gave the impression of greasy boils covering his skin. He was snorting plumes of cold exhaust. So there's this amazing triple movement where you've got a straight character, a straight man, who sees his gay black friend boxing half naked. And you've got this movement of describing his body as first wet chocolate, which is something delicious and desirable. And then immediately, because that's a delicious, desirable thing, you've got to talk about the sweat on his body looking like greasy boils, which is a repellent thing and an unhealthy thing and the thing you don't want to get close to or touch or certainly taste, unlike the chocolate. And then there's this further distancing by then describing this man as a machine, like he has, his breath is exhaust. So you completely take from this desirable image into a completely undesirable image, and then you reduce the person to a machine. And it's just fascinating. Like, it's this little microcosm of how Leonard is often depicted through the words in this book, and in not anything explicit as that, but in the same way Trudy and
Angel.
Yeah,
but how do you read that though?
Exactly as I read it, as I told you.
No, but what's the outcome of that? That Hap slash Lansdale is possibly vaguely attracted to his friend but can't admit it to himself, or?
That seems to be, like to me, that would be the subtext of that. However, I don't think it's deliberate. I think it's careless writing. But careless writing comes from somewhere, right? It comes from the author. The words are chosen by the author. How carefully and deliberately the words are chosen, we don't know. But I just found that particular paragraph on a text basis, how that transformed this second protagonist, like not the protagonist, but the main character, other than our viewpoint protagonist, transformed him into something repellent and a machine, in the same way that referring to Trudy constantly either as a bird or as only talking about her sexual characteristics and performance reduces her to that. And I don't think the book is playing playing with that deliberately because none of it is sort of reinforced throughout the book. None of it is followed up. It's just these one-off descriptions. Like it never comes back. It's just this one-off thing with the description of Leonard. It never comes back. It never comes back to Hap. So, which is why I don't think it is a deliberate thing. But it's fascinating. It's fascinating to see what happens with language and that movement through the three levels.
I did not pick that at all. Although that passage is, I remember when you read, I knew exactly what you
meant. Yeah, right. So it's, and the language like that kind of, I did it all through the book. I don't know.
See,
there was careless metaphors. There were careless things.
In rereading it, the Trudy thing stuck out to me.
Yeah. And she's also so passive. Like whenever Trudy does have sex, and she has sex a lot, the descriptions are all of her in the passive voice. She gave herself to me.
But I did like the fact.
It's all like she's a very, for a woman who is on the surface portrayed ostensibly as predatory and manipulative, she's just extremely passive.
In that sense, but I did like the fact that even under torture, which happens in the last third, she doesn't give up where the money is. And there's things like that. So there is some depth to her as a character. She isn't completely one note, but then she does end up getting killed, although everyone gets killed other than Happen Leonard. Look, it did rankle with me when I did the reread because – Yes, also, it is male gaze and all that sort of stuff. And I've been educated since, obviously brainwashed. I've been educated since I last read this book. Yeah. But I think the book beyond that, I'm not saying it's not, I don't want to use the word problematic. I hate it. I'm not saying it's not an issue. Is a novel very much as in the blurb is a statement that the 60s were there, now the 80s have come along because it's published in 99.
Yeah.
The 80s have come along and the 80s is essentially a cynical reaction to the 60s.
Yeah.
And that's what this book is. It's an extremely cynical take on the left side of politics.
Yeah, because ostensibly, the blurb said, they're going to find all this money, which was hidden from a holdup that Howard, Trudy's current guy, was a cellmate with a guy who told him about this money. Anyway, all this sort of stuff. So the one group of people are going to use it to further, the cause, whatever their cause is, and Hap and Leonard just want to use it to live on.
Yeah.
They're not interested. But the other thing is, it's like,
But I really liked that cynical move for Hap. Way he goes from goes to prison because he doesn't want to be in the Vietnam War deliberately, even though he's the person bringing him the army official who's speaking to him at the time says, "Look, mate, just say you want to be a pacifist or whatever. Don't make a big deal of it,
because
we have to put you in jail. Otherwise, he wants to make a big deal of it.
Yeah.
And then the 18 months have passed, and how it just begins to fade away for him, and not helped by the fact that Trudy leaves him.
Yeah.
And because that's the big thing, he's going to come out in 18 months and be the hero who took the bullet for everyone, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah.
And Trudy would be there to hug him, be there for him, but she isn't.
And that's it's interesting, isn't it? Because his whole motivation for doing that is very ego driven.
Oh yeah,
it's
absolutely. But Hap is a very ego driven.
And when it doesn't become about him anymore, then he kind of forgets about it all.
Yeah. and then for the rest of his life has now said, well, that's fucked me over. I'm going to be wasted potential in a sense.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, it's extremely cynical in that sense, which is why I liked it so much.
I mean, and
the fact that you've got Leonard, chocolate greasy boils aside, when it came out, this idea of having a black gay man, which is made more of as the books go on, because the way it's introduced here, it's done through dialogue. It's not, oh, here's Leonard, my black gay friend.
Yeah.
You don't even know he's black. To begin with, it's done gradually through dialogue. It was, innovative of it on itself, on its own. Is a tokenism. It was not, no, because I think Leonard is maybe you should have figured out that they were being, betrayed or, whatever. But
that's the mechanics of the book.
But Leonard is a very well realized character, and Macho Mojo and the rest of the books do that even further. I mean, the second book is all about Leonard. It's not through his perspective, but it's all about his dead uncle and there's a crack den nearby. I mean, I only have vague memories, but it's all about Leonard. So that was interesting and that was new and it still feels unfortunately new.
Yeah, I can see that.
But for me, the highlight's the cynicism. And the dark humor that runs through it. Yes, I know.
Yeah, the dark. I mean, and some of the jokes were quite funny.
You did laugh. Come on.
I did.
I know there's like, that ongoing gag with Angel and the baddie, whose name I've forgotten. Although I could just bring it up on the interwebs. It's such a stupid joke that he kept. What's the word for it, Angel? And she keeps, you know, these compliments. Yeah, yeah. And it is such a fucking stupid gag, and yet I laughed every time. Because it is such a caricature. It really is, but it's funny.
That's what it is. Like every character except I get for Hap because he's
and there is an over the top element to Lansdowne and to this world. This is not. Even though it is playing around with the real stuff about the 60s and the 80s, when it gets down to the guts and gore of the actual plot, this is over-the-top shit. Quentin Tarantino, whatever. This is all over the top.
Your ultimate villains are completely, caricature-ish cardboard.
Soldier. That's his name.
Soldier, right. Villains, that's who they are, right? And Angel and Soldier, that's who they are.
I mean, and Chubb, the real pacifist of the Howard's group, is an absolute caricature.
Absolutely.
Because Lansdowne is deliberately poking fun at that sort of idealist view, because how could you possibly still be idealistic when Reagan's been in office? I mean, that's what it is. It is a complete breakdown of what the 60s was about. Now, it's funny how we have a different view in 2016 about that. In fact, what I loved about this book, looking back on it, is that now it's 2016 and we look at the 80s in a nostalgic sort of butterfly sort of way. The 80s, the big hair and all that. And we less connected, although some do, but we less connected to Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher and, the destruction of a dream, because we're 30 years past that. But this is a book that's directly saying, the 80s is a cynical response to the 60s.
And it was. I mean, you could definitely say it was. I don't know. I all of that was fine. I just found, I guess, the characters to just be very... I don't know. Maybe it gets better as the series goes on, but I found
it should work in this book.
Flat.
You shouldn't have to read four novels to figure out.
I'm just saying I found them to be a bit flat, overly harnessed to the plot mechanics, and that's and part of this is because, as I said, I never felt close to Hap's character. Because here's the flip side. Here is the flip side of saying, as the book does on several occasions, through both Leonard and Hap. At one point Leonard calls her a succubus.
Yes, he does. Leonard's real mean. True.
But Hap backs it up, right? Hap backs everything up.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So the flip side.
Perhaps this is my dick talking.
Yeah. But the flip side of saying that Trudy is a succubus and that she just get meant to drop her pants with the bat of an eyelid and all of this sort of stuff is that doesn't that make Hap unbelievably stupid? Like, either Trudy is an actual succubus.
No, I think that's the whole point of this novel.
So
Hap has been led by his cock from page one to page 100 and whatever it is.
I know, and I just found that quite boring.
And the hilarious bit is Leonard saying, "You are being led by your cock," and Hap going, "Well, yeah, but."
And I guess I just found that incredibly boring. I found it incredibly boring.
To me, that all wraps up in the theme of the book, that this is Hap who's stuck. What we realise, this is a man who's mentally stuck in a period of time that he just cannot get over.
Yeah, I know.
He just can't get over it.
I know.
I mean, look, this thing's over. I mean, yeah, look, and then when they have the final gunfight, I don't know how many times happened Lenny gets shot. They said he shot about 43 times.
He managed to survive.
Somehow. So, yeah, Trudy gets shot once and that's it. She just should have done it.
Yeah.
So she's a goner. I mean, there's all that silly stuff, but I don't know. I don't want to reduce it down to just simple escapist fiction because I think Lansdowne's too good a writer. I know you think he uses words carelessly.
I think the language in this book is very careless.
I don't agree with you entirely, but I do agree with you somewhat. So that's interesting. That's carelessly
I'm not saying every line is terrible. I'm just saying
is very entertaining for me for a boy. Well, here we go. I do wonder. Let's get completely sexist and on all this. I do wonder whether this is boys' fiction.
But if it's bad fiction.
No, but I don't think it's.
But isn't that what you're saying? You're saying, like, women.
No, the boys.
Are you saying that women won't enjoy this because of, the female characters are caricatured?
Possibly.
And blah, blah, blah. But doesn't that make it bad fiction?
Yeah, but this comes down to the core of this nub of the whole argument about fully developed characters and what we're talking about with Shriver. That of me, when I was in my
20s,
I don't give a fuck how Trudy's described.
Yeah. And she probably felt quite legitimate to you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. As a woman, right?
I'd read crime fiction. She's a femme fatale.
Yeah.
You know, they're all evil and nasty and they all double cross you. Yeah. That's probably what you were thinking of before, double cross.
Double cross, that's the word, yes.
They all double cross you. Yeah. You know, that's just core of this genre. I mean, what makes this different is we've got Leonard and the hyper over the top shit at the end, you know, because.
With Soldier and Angel.
Yeah. That's what makes it different. But Trudy, and Trudy herself has some slight, because, let's be clear on one thing. Trudy never diverges from her goal.
No.
This is not about her filling her pockets. She genuinely is doing this for a cause. She doesn't give a fuck about Howard and she doesn't give a fuck about Hap, really. But that's why she doesn't give up where the money is.
Yeah. That's why she hides the money.
So Lansdale is trying to – not subvert, because subvert's too big a word.
I think Ingletree is subversive.
No, but he is slightly –
yeah.
Nudging it in a direction that is a bit different to what the normal. But yeah, look, I can see you read that. You go, and I did. I read it. I went, yeah, Trudy, yeah, this is going to bug Kirsten. I already knew I was reading it. I did, I swear. Kirsten, I remember I was at a play centre looking after Sophie. I'm reading the last one. I thought, this Trudy thing. Especially when she gets shot, I thought that's going to be the fight because it becomes an angsty, fridgy sort of thing at
and
the
end.
And
it's not, I guess, what it, like, Trudy's there, and like, I bet I read the bit about Leonard and, like, as you were saying, the character of Chubb, who's this kind of character, but like
he's a comic relief.
Yeah, and but that's saying he's a fat guy, and he's like his physicality is joked, like it is made an object of derision.
But he's also part of the 1%. They justify because his family's extremely rich.
Yeah,
he himself thinks he's Lord Fauntleroy. You know, so.
I guess I just see the book taking a lot of cheap shots.
Yeah. Oh, fucking full of them.
But
there are some astonishing moments, like when they go under, when Hap goes underwater, and that cold that he feels because it's in the lake.
And the disorientation he gets because he's under for too long and it's too dark and he can't. And that's what happens.
And I would argue Lansdale's gotten better writer-wise than this, but you'll never know because you'll never read another book by him.
I'm not tempted.
No, I mean, when was the last time you read a crime novel or hard-boiled novel that you liked? Seriously.
Well, I don't read a lot of them. It would be Megan...
Yes, there you go, Megan Abbott.
Abbott,
Yes, exactly. She is definitely playing against the conventions. But this is very entertaining, well-written novel.
This is the problem with the convention, that's what I mean. Like
I'm not excusing conventions.
When things become calcified in conventions.
I agree, and I'm not excusing them.
And I just don't find that enjoyable. It's not that I would necessarily
But in 1990, when Ian Mond, and I didn't read it in 1990, I would have read it in mid-90s, so Ian was 21, 22. This is great.
Yeah.
Give me more.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And frankly, I now want to reread the rest.
I know. And is some of that nostalgia?
Yes.
Yes.
But also I want to get up to date. I want to see if things do improve.
And it's completely – and I'm not saying that –
Yes,
that,
you are.
I'm not saying that – I'm allowing this book to have been published in the 90s. I'm not saying like this is a – I'm not judging this book the way I would judge it if it was published right now today, if it was a new novel published in 2016. Like I'm allowing it a lot of leeway for how the genre was moving back then and so on. But at the same time, this is – part of why there were great sways of the genre that I didn't like back in the 90s because this is where it was and I probably couldn't have articulated it as well back then. But it's probably why I didn't ever read a Joe Lansdale novel because I read his short fiction and it was like, nah. Yeah.
Do I have to mention The Night They Missed the Horror Show again?
I have read that one. It's fine. Do I love it? No. Did it make me read his novels? No.
All right. Look, I read Splatterpunk as well. And
like Splatterpunk.
Yeah, but a lot of it is misogynistic at a high level.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I guess that's the difference. I don't have an objection to like explicit violence or gore or anything.
I know
like
you don't.
That, right?
I know you don't.
So yeah, so it's not like any genre part of this book that I didn't like. And I guess that's the thing that runs through it. I don't think you needed Trudy to be this very stereotypical femme fatale character for this book. It would have been a better book if she wasn't. I don't think you needed to poke fun at a big fat guy and his fatness and physicality becoming part of the joke of who he was as a character. And all of this stuff is tangled up.
I'm going to call it because we need to move on. I'm going to call it charming crassness.
I'll go with the crassness part of that.
Charmed.
I was not charmed.
I would recommend this book still. I don't give a fuck about it. Nah, so I do. But, yeah, I gave it 4 stars on Goodreads, and I hold by that.
Okay.
It's possible I've been reading a lot of Man Booker long list books this week. When I was,
so this was a palate cleanser.
Oh, fuck yes. Oh, there's some really bad stuff for the Man Booker this
week. A book with action, a book with jokes.
No, no, no. It's not just that. It's not just, oh, it's escapist and I like it. There's just some really
I didn't say escapist. I said action and jokes.
But even, no.
That's not necessarily
but there's some dirge-worthy books this year. The book has been better in other years. Anyway. Let's move on to The Pillow Friend.
So I chose The Pillow Friend, and this is a book that you gave me for my birthday years and years and years ago. It was originally published in 96, so it's a bit older from than
still 20 years.
A bit younger than Savage Season. And I don't know why he gave it to me. It isn't like I was a massive Lisa Tuttle fan or anything, but I read it, and it's a funny thing. Like it was one of my top 50 books, right, or fave 50 books that we did back in February or March, whenever that was. And I remembered really liking the book. I remembered being troubled, like in a good way, by the book. I didn't remember much about the story, and it was fascinating rereading it. It was disturbing on
well, can I just jump in for one sec?
Yeah.
Your second novel.
No, as I was about to say, it was disturbing on one part. It was like, oh, my God, I see so much of what inspired and informed Perfections in this book. And I wonder, and in a weird way.
I was
going
to say that was subconscious because you wouldn't have actively tried to copy Lisa.
I had completely forgotten 80% of this book. And the fact that it obviously stuck with me so strongly, because I didn't start writing Perfections probably until 10 years after I finished, after I read this book, right? And it came from, I say at once, a completely different point of inspiration than The Pillow Friend, but at the same time, an identical place of inspiration as The Pillow Friend. It's fascinating. But so let's just say what the book's about. And then, oh no, there is a blurb. There we go. So I'll just read it out. It's quicker. Agnes Gray, a young child growing up in Houston, Texas in the early 60s, is troubled by her mother's depressive and erratic mood swings. She escapes to a delusional dream state where she finds that her made-up relationships are more gratifying and often more tangible than her real ones. A beloved porcelain doll whispers unintelligible mutterings to her well into the night. An enigmatic high school boyfriend appears upon command to silently fulfill her adolescent desires. A handsome and soulful English poet steals her away to serve as his devoted muse. Aunt Marjorie, whose cameo appearances are peppered with tales of life abroad, warns Agnes that she must be prepared to deal with the consequences of what she wishes for. And as Agnes approaches and enters adulthood, her fantastical relationships and their consequences become deceptively real with a chilling and bizarre aftermath. Which is a really good, like, blurb for the book.
It's a lot of
Very impressed. No, I'm pretty impressed with that. That's what blurbs do.
And aftermath.
But so here's what I remembered. Here's what I remembered from The Pillow Friend. I remembered that Aunt Marjorie isn't real and that she's actually Agnes's mother pretending to be her own twin sister. I remembered that. I remembered the gammon, the ham on the plate. Yes. I remembered that. And that scene in the restaurant where she wants to taste this ham steak and her husband doesn't like sharing his food. I remembered that scene. I didn't remember the porcelain doll. I didn't remember the actual pillow friend. I did not remember the scene where she eats the pillow friend while she's fucking him and his penis breaks off inside her. How did I not remember that?
That would have marked me.
Did not remember it. I remembered the phantom pregnancy, and I thought that happened halfway through the book. And that I just didn't remember what came after that. I didn't realize that's like the very end of the book.
Yeah.
So there was a whole bunch of stuff that I just did not remember at all, and was almost it was almost completely new to me. Like reading that scene, it wasn't even as I was reading it, I remembered it. It was like completely quite new. I remembered when she went to Aunt Marjorie's cabin, but I remember that as a much bigger movement in the book, and I didn't remember the horse. Which is interesting.
Yeah, you love horses.
I know. I'm reading this book and how have I not remembered this? So it's so fascinating to reread because I love it. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And in terms of I shat on Joe Lansdale a bit for his carelessness in language. I think Tuttle's language in The Pillow Friend is so on point. It's remarkable. Every analogy she makes, every metaphor, every all of the language she uses.
Yeah, of course your book has better language than mine.
Well, I'll give two very concrete examples. So there's one where she meets Graham, the poet.
Yep.
And he asks her to dinner and she feels – and the metaphor that Tuttle uses is that – and this is a third-person account. So the metaphor that she uses is it feels like she's super happy and excited and it's like this balloon blowing up inside her. And it's amazing because it not only does it invoke a physical sensation which maps quite readily onto our experiences of being in infatuation and so on, but when you drill down to that metaphor, what happens is that if there's a balloon swelling up inside of you, it will choke you, it will kill you. It's not a good thing. Like, it's this most wonderful crafting of layers of meaning in this single metaphor. And for another example, there's like the whole time she's married to Graham and she's in London and he refers to her as Nancy, which in the UK is a shortening of Angus, a common shortening. It's in Scotland a common shortening of Agnes. And I went back and skimmed through it again, and for the most part, even though it's a third person point of view narrative, for the time that she's with Graham, Tuttle almost never uses her name Agnes. It's just she. And because she's the only character on the page for much of it, that's fine. You know who she is. But that means that whenever Graham speaks and calls her Nancy, you get this abrupt little jolt for a second. Like, oh, who's Nancy? Oh, that's right. It's you know. And because she's taken away the word Agnes, it's almost like Agnes has lost a lot of her identity and is becoming Graham Story's wife, Nancy, and you get this wonderful jolt, and that's purely in the way she's constructed the language and how she describes Agnes in that section of the book, and it's quite remarkable. I think that the writing here is deceptively simple because it is quite straightforward language, but she has chosen the words she uses with such care, and she has imbued such layers of meaning in a lot of the language and the metaphors that she chooses to use when she does use them, because she uses them sparingly. And I just, it's quite an astonishing
it's
book.
I loved it. It's extraordinary novel.
It really, really is. I'm so sad this isn't a better known book.
Oh, shit. Well, hopefully this podcast will do that. I love how it ebbs and flows. I love how it the magical element, if that's what it is, ebbs and flows.
Well,
it is
a magic. Yeah, you don't know. For a lot of the book, you're not sure.
Well, you're never sure, really.
Yeah.
Because no one we're never given evidence that anyone else recognises. I mean, her mum's mad as well.
Oh, is she mad or is she?
That made no connection, what I just said there. Well, we never know. Mum's mad.
Mad, by the way. But this is the thing.
No, like, but her mum's the only other external source that could verify that. For example, so there is.
Well, she has got this phantom, this magical pregnancy. Unless you think the midwife Nancy is also.
No. I think the midwife. Mm. Well, it's interesting that the midwife Nancy's name is Nancy, but no, it's not that. It's phantom pregnancies are a thing.
Yeah, they
do happen.
Yeah, I know, but this is what I mean. Like, these things have happened.
And
like,
all we know is that
she's able to influence reality to a certain extent, is what I'm
well,
saying.
Well, no, the phantom pregnancies can happen whether you're magical or not.
Yeah, I know.
So, no, that if you're Nancy the midwife, you're not turning around and go, oh, my fucking God, there's no baby in here.
No, but we know from the – like, we know the line of events. So no, I know phantom pregnancies happen. But
the line
fact
of
that
events,
she
could still have been – the phantom pregnancy could still be as a result of something natural. It doesn't necessarily
– sure.
Because she's got – whatever the hell that is up her hoo-ha, this cock
but
up her.
The fact that it was triggered, or the fact that, like, in the narrative, the turn of events that happens, like, yes, it would be a coincidence if it just so happened that she had a phantom pregnancy at the same time that she imagines this thing to happen. Like, you make the linkage.
Yep.
That whether or not the pillow friend is a real material thing, Agnes's fantasies about what happened has triggered.
What's fascinating.
Pregnancy.
There's very little verification for anything that ever happens.
Mm.
So, for example, when she has the horse and she brings the horse to the house or the little shack, her auntie/mother never really recognizes the horse is there. There's never, hey, you've got a white horse. What the fuck is that? It's implied that it's there, but never fully recognised. When she questions Graham as to, well, what did it when we were in our auntie's shack and we were having all this great sex? Well, again, it's never that direct a conversation, by the by, but what happened for you? He doesn't provide a straight answer. It's all very – nothing is externally verified in that sense. You never have two characters agreeing with anything that's
– no. Going
on, which is what is brilliant about it, by the way. That's not, that's not a negative.
And the thing that's interesting is that you can take out a lot of – not take out, but you can leave aside the fantastical stuff. And this is a wonderful depiction of human interactions.
Oh, yeah. This is great.
We don't agree on what happened in situations. Magic aside.
Correct.
You know, I experienced it this way. You experienced it that way. And often our memories of what has happened in the same experience that we've shared with another person are quite different to their memories. Sometimes on a very material level, it's like, oh, no, this happened. No, I think it happened this way.
Yeah.
But even without that, even if we can all agree on the facts of the matter, our experience of what happened is quite different. You know, what you felt about an experience and how you subjectively remember it will be different to how someone else having the identical experience at the same time subjectively experiences it and then recalls it and then organizes it into their view of themselves and the world. So that in itself was this wonderful, really nuanced sort of.
It was irritating. She never seems to want to have direct conversations with anyone. Let's say her first crush, the young guy whose name I've forgotten, even though I just read this recently.
Well, no, but she tries.
Yeah,
several. He's avoiding her because, like, well, like the magical being that she conjured, which she thinks is him for quite a while because she's forgotten she can do this. Is one thing, but the actual boy is just avoiding her. So she actually doesn't get, like, he's not in school the next day, and then he's not, you know, like, he is avoiding her. And then the one time she does try to bring it up, a whole bunch of his friends come and sit down and take, you know, like, she does, like, I think.
Until then she clicks that it must.
And then she clicks that he does, like, because then when she does say something and he goes, oh, I don't know what you're talking, you know, it. So there is this, yeah, like I think Tuttle balances that quite well between this allowing Agnes time to think what she's experiencing is real and having that verified or unverified or invalidated, I guess is the word. But the fact that it happens throughout the book and by the end of the book, I think you're on very unsteady feet about what is or isn't real.
Correct.
And how real was Graham? And
oh, I think Graham was.
Oh, I think Graham is real, but in the cabin was Graham real?
No, that's a good question.
You know, like how not if Graham is real, but how real is Graham? What parts of him?
But then
was
where the fuck was Graham? Where was he? I mean, did she even go to the cabin with Graham? We don't know.
It's really strange, isn't it? It's such a strange book, and it's not for me anyway. It wasn't an unpleasant doubt. It wasn't like, oh, for fuck's sake, this book can't make up its mind. Like, it was just instilling this doubt as a reader. You couldn't trust what you were reading any more than Agnes could trust what she was experiencing a lot of the time. And there's that wonderful bit in the middle where she writes about, she goes to London and she goes to the house and to the poet's house, you know, to Graham's house, because she hasn't met him at that stage, but she has this idea that she might go to London and meet him, and then she says, oh, but I won't do that. And then the next chapter is her going to London and turning up at his house, and you get this whole bit. And as I was reading it, and she's talking about she went to the house and the ex-girlfriend was there, and then she ends up in a relationship with him, and it ends up being this really wonderful short story within the novel, and then that's exactly what it is.
It's
a short story that Agnes has written and published somewhere in fantasy magazine.
Yeah, no, it was the FNSF. The actual FNSF.
But while you're reading this story, like, I started reading it and I didn't think it was a fantasy. I thought, oh, she's actually gone to London, and that was the joke, because the very last line of the previous section was like, oh, but there's no way I'm going to go to London and meet him. And then it's like, and so Agnes is walking up to Graham Story's house, and so that it lulls you into that without thinking about its reality by levering it off a joke, because that's funny. When we laugh, we are a bit less critical about things we find funny. So it leverages that off a joke, and then it takes a little while to think about the stuff that's happening in this and how it's now seeming quite story-like.
Yeah.
Right? The mechanics of that particular section. And then, of course, it doesn't give you much time to kind of think, oh, this must be one of Agnes's fantasies, because before you turn the page and you realise, oh, it was actually a story that she wrote based on imagining what it might be like to go and meet Graham's story. But then when she actually meets Graham, because Tuttle has preempted that meeting with this story, with this fantasy, you're not certain what's real about that.
No, true. That's right.
So she's very clever in the structure of the book and how she quite gently pulls the rug out from you in one section. But having pulled that rug out, you're now a bit more suspicious of possible rugs
that are around
further on in the book.
But what about her? What about her relationship with men generally? Because it's a book all about desire, and she has lots of unfulfilled desires.
Yeah, it's this, and I think that's if there is, and I don't really think there's a central message in the book, but certainly one of the themes that it threads throughout the book quite strongly is that I guess the danger of fantasy, in that the danger of imagining to perfect a partner, to perfect a relationship, to perfect a realization of desire, and imagining that, and in Agnes's case, materially experiencing that, then by necessity undermines the reality of those relationships.
But she just moves from one.
No person you know can be perfect. No person.
No, but
you know,
she moves from one crushing disappointment to the next. Although she.
But they're not that crushing.
Well, no.
That's the thing. Like, they're deeply crushing to her.
This is one of the problems I had with her as a character, that she just keeps them. Like the Graham thing, she should have left him yonks prior to when she does.
Yeah, but she's so invested in this fantastical idea that's what I mean. That like the end of the book is so disturbing because she's completely succumbs now to this fantasy of the baby, which isn't there.
Yeah,
but a fantasy baby might be there.
Yeah,
and you kind of get this like very closed, dark little image of Agnes in this little cottage in Scotland, which isn't hers. And we know she won't be able to stay there forever.
The bothy.
The bothy. And, you know, she's there with this magical baby, which isn't a real baby, any more real than the pillow friend was or any of the other pillow friends. And she's kind of caught in her own mind. But she's so empowered by that.
But it's so depressing.
I know. That's what I mean. It's like it's this danger of.
I mean, clearly she's heading in the same direction as her mother.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's this danger of allowing the fantastic to
because her sisters are genuinely surprised that she didn't twig.
Absolutely.
That her mother and Marjorie were the same person.
Yeah. Did you twig?
No.
No.
Well, how could I?
No. It's so well done. It's so cleverly done. Like I knew. I remembered. I didn't twig the first time. No, it was complete. I remember being completely surprised.
But there aren't clues, though. I don't know. Maybe there were when you reread it.
When I reread it, I wouldn't call them clues, but everything makes sense. There's at no time
that they're in the same room.
Tuttle cheats.
It's not like in the same room.
No. There is not one occasion in the book, because as I said, that was one of the things I remembered. I remembered that Marjorie was an alter ego of Agnes's mother.
This is where I got confused.
And there's not one part where Tuttle cheats.
But this is what makes the whole, puts it all, shines a completely different light on things. The father and mother have an argument about her going to Hollywood.
Yeah.
But that's obviously not the argument that's being had. The argument is that the mother doesn't want to go to Hollywood. She wants to go back to the shack.
She wants to be Marjorie for a few weeks.
That's right.
This is like the deeply tragic story, because the characters are so well drawn, even though the father's not on screen for a while, and Agnes's mother as Mary is not on screen for a lot of the time.
Correct.
We get more Marjorie than we get Mary, but you get this wonderful, well, it's wonderfully done. You get this awful sense of how this family manages to hold itself together, clearly in retrospect, for the sake of the children, because as soon as Agnes, who is the youngest, is old enough, there's a divorce, and the father never comes back to see him.
Never comes back.
No.
He's off.
Right. But you get the feeling of his role, like keeping within this family for the sake of his daughters, when he has a wife who regularly says to him, I need to go and be Marjorie. And he plays up with the pretense because his daughters and Agnes, like until her mother dies, thinks Marjorie was real. And the older twin sisters she has must at some point have thought might. So the father is playing along with the idea of Marjorie, because it's not like Marjorie is a secret between Mary and Agnes.
Yeah.
Marjorie, Mary's sister, is acknowledged by everyone in the family as existing, yes, as being a person. So the father is having to play along with this. He's having to play along with his wife's instability or whatever this is, because Mary, one of the refreshing things about this book is Mary was, she was never maligned. She was never depicted as this, you know, crazy person. She was never.
Until I did about 20 minutes ago.
Until you did it about 20 minutes. Yeah. But within the book, yeah, she wasn't. And it's like every few months, Mary, who's confined into this very, I guess, stereotypical view of 50s and 60s motherhood, and she's, which she's put herself into, and you get the impression she has perhaps voluntarily put herself into this mold as a way of trying to, yeah, cope and trying to be real in the world and not be unstable. But every so often it's too much and she has to go away and be Marjorie. And her husband at once, although he doesn't, clearly doesn't like it, supports her in that for as long as,
yeah, but he,
the marriage needs to,
he also doesn't know that she's shagging a pillow friend.
I don't, we don't know, he doesn't know. He may clearly know. He may know. He may know everything. Hmm. Like it's such an amazing relationship to think about, like to think about what's behind the pages when you start. Well, here's what we know. Here's what Agnes knows. So what does that tell you about the relationship between her parents and especially her father and how he,
yeah,
like it's such, like his actions towards his wife have such generosity.
Yeah, except he then doesn't recognize his kids.
Well, no, because he's done. Like it wears him out, as it would, I think. Like Mary is living a double life voluntarily by her own choice.
But to dismiss your children,
he's
though,
not. That's forced upon him.
But he's okay. He's worn out. Fine. But yeah, to dismiss your children forever, at least for the length of this novel,
yeah,
including the twins who are very much are detached from everything. That's,
yeah,
going,
I think it's absolutely tragic. Like I think the what happens in Agnes's family because of this fantastical, whether you think that it's real or not, it's deeply, deeply tragic. It's something that drives a complete wedge through the entire family. And as soon as everyone is old enough, the family disintegrates. Like it's, yeah, deeply, deeply tragic. But Agnes's story is told in a way that, like, she doesn't even notice of it. She's so caught up in her own fantasies, whether they're literal fantasies with the pillow friend, yep, or whether they're just fantastical imaginings about what her life might be and who she might be.
Yeah.
She's so caught up in that. But I think the skill of Tuttle as an author is to let you see enough of that you know that.
You know,
can put
brilliant,
those pieces together.
When
you
say
see
that,
this deeply, deeply tragic family and what happens to them because of what's behind.
But what's
what
brilliant
sees,
is that although she lives in her head a lot, you never see Agnes as anything but actually quite practical. She's a very practical person.
Practical, very pragmatic.
Like she gets a job. She does, you know.
Yeah, she's very capable.
She has adult conversations with her yep, husbands, with the men and women in her yep, life. This is not a woman who's la la la.
No, and neither is Mary. Mary is very capable. While she's married, Mary is very capable.
While she's married, correct. Yeah, and that's what's real. That's yeah, what I found very likable. Because easily you could just get so fucking annoyed with Agnes yeah, and say, you know, but she's extremely likable, extremely sympathetic, and I do love.
She's so silly. Like sometimes you just, like you say, you want to shake her sometimes,
yeah,
saying, just leave him.
Yes.
Just stop doing that.
Yeah.
Like she's not this completely, like she's not Pollyanna.
She gets hoodwinked easily. Like she doesn't pick that her yeah, friend Alice is with her. She, yeah, these things sort of go right over her
yeah,
head.
Yeah, she's naive.
Yes, naive. Yeah. Like, for example, the thing. And again, it's one of those where she just couldn't accept the fantasy over the reality that her mother or Aunt Marjorie makes a book called Agnes Grey, which is an actual
oh my goodness
real book.
Me.
But she goes through most of her life thinking that the book she read, Agnes Grey, is not the is Bronte, isn't it? It's not
yes,
the is the same as the Bronte book,
which is amazing.
So she never only later does someone actually give her husband Graham gives yeah, her a copy of Agnes Grey, the Bronte, and she starts reading and goes, wait a minute, where are all
this
the,
is not the book I read.
Where's the dragons or whatever? Because it was a more fantastical.
Yeah. But isn't that remarkable though? Like it's so. And I didn't pick that the first time I read. In fact, I don't think I remembered it, so I didn't pick it this time either, because she's at that party with the academics.
Yeah.
And one of them makes a comment about, oh, God, Agnes Grey, that's such a – because her name is Agnes Grey. Yeah. We should say that. Her name is Agnes Grey. So I don't think a namesake because of this book. But anyway, so she's at this party and one of the academics makes a joke about her name. And then there's this bit of a discussion about the book and he thinks it's a really dreary book. And she's going, oh, no, it's amazing and blah, blah, blah. And I've read Agnes Grey like a long time ago at uni. But even when she's talking, like, and I knew that's not quite, that wasn't really the book, but I'm still thinking, she has misremembered, she's created this kind of, and I'd completely forgotten that actually what Mary as Marjorie has done is written out this completely different, and typed it out and bound it and given her this book called Agnes Grey.
Correct.
She has no idea until she.
Written by Anne Bronte.
By Anne Bronte. And she has no idea. And I had no idea until you get to that scene. But how remarkable is that? How remarkable a thing is that for her mother as Marjorie to have done, to have made this story about her daughter who bears the name of the heroine of this rather, dull heroine.
It is dull.
I don't remember much about the book, to be honest. I really don't. I know I've read it. I don't remember much. It certainly wasn't a favourite book.
She's so caught in the fantasy of it. She's never gone and verified. She's never walked into a bookstore and said, well, there, wow, Agnes Grey.
She misplaced her own copy and never went and bought another one.
That's
until
right.
Her husband did. Like, that's what I mean. There's this.
And you sort of think to yourself, well, how realistic is that? To one extent.
Except
and then you
that
go,
she's just
but it's consistent.
Up.
It's consistent within the
it's
narrative
consistent
of the book.
Consistent with Agnes. What an amazing.
And this is a woman who works in publishing.
But what an amazing act of love.
Oh, yeah,
on behalf
absolutely.
Of her mother to make this for her daughter, the way I read that is this is the, making this fantastical version of Agnes Grey, which is full of derring do you know, from what Agnes describes it as, gone from being a rather sedate and mousy sort of governess type character. So she's offering this as a gift to her daughter, as a way to free her daughter, to point her towards what might be possible for her daughter, because she can't, as Mary or as Marjorie, have this conversation with her daughter. So she said she's crafted this book. First of all, she's written the book and then she's crafted the book as an artifact and given that to her. It's just like, it gives me chills. It's the most wonderful.
And yet, gift. As Marjorie.
And yet at the same time, it is undermining her daughter's ability to function in the real world because it's this.
And
emblem.
That's why I wonder the whole thing with Miles, the porcelain doll, is that the dueling aspects of mum, of Mary, Marjorie. Marjorie gives the doll.
Yep. And Mary doesn't
and
want
Mary
her
doesn't
to
want
have,
to have
the
doll.
Like it's because we should say that it's the Marjorie aspect who gives Agnes the fantastical Agnes Grey.
But Mary doesn't take that away from
her.
No,
she doesn't take that away
one's
from
all right.
Her. Yeah.
But the porcelain doll, which Agnes calls Miles,
because I guess the book itself is not magic. It doesn't. It doesn't have any magical
again,
ability.
Again, we don't really know how magical Miles is.
Whereas Miles apparently does. It's just like, there's so much, there's just so many layers in this book.
Well, the bit where she walks, she's wandering around London and finds a shop and she can see Miles in there and they can never find that shop again.
Yeah.
Just these little bits that happen throughout the book.
There's weird little.
But you said before, and you were right.
I can see this is
why
I'm going to read again.
Why is this book not more? I mean, Tuttle herself has got, you know, a decent career, I assume, as an author. I don't know. I mean, she's.
I've read other of her work.
But why isn't this book had more love?
I think it's a troublesome book. Like, it doesn't end in. Like, I can see why this book is not a commercial success, put it that way. Right? It's
beautifully written.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not of the set of narratives that achieve commercial success.
Wait a sec. I'm not talking about it selling 100 million copies. Yeah. I'm talking. Selling 25, 30,000.
Why isn't it more of a cult favourite?
No, not even from a genre perspective. Just
to
from
be honest,
a general.
To be fair, I don't know how this book did at the time. I just know it's not a book I hear about. It's not a book I probably would have heard about if you had not bought it for me 20 years ago. And I hadn't heard of it when you bought it for me. It was like, oh, what's this book you've bought? But yeah, it's quite fascinating, and I want to read it. I can see this now becoming a book I will read every decade or so. It's like, oh, I think I need to read The Pillow Friend again.
Yeah, just for the bit where she eats her lover.
That's the most remarkable scene, and I am just I am floored that I absolutely do not remember it. I found the scene shocking.
Okay, so it looks like it was.
And then I was even more shocked that I didn't remember it. It's like, how could I not? How is this not burned into my brain?
Okay, so.
It is now. It's there now. I won't forget it.
From what I can see, it was published, as you said,
96.
Except that's there actually is no 96. The version that you're that's there, yes, says 91 in Goodreads. So it's clearly not 99.
No, it's copyright. I'm looking at it. It's this first edition, copyright 1996.
Yes, I don't know if I can trust this.
September 1996, in fact.
But it has been reissued. Joe Fletcher Books actually reissued it in 2012.
Oh.
And there's been a reissue of the ebook in 2014. It also was reissued by Bantam in 2005. Yeah. So it's had a decent life. It just, you're right, no one talks about it.
Yeah, it is an astonishingly good book. And it's a very
I mean, it's only got 96 ratings in Goodreads.
Well, there you go. But I think it's also, and we touched on this a little, it's a very generous book in terms of all the characters who inhabit it. There's like even Graham, who is not a wonderful character. He's not a monster. He's not horrible. And Agnes's boyfriend in high school, who she hooks up with again later in college, is not horrible. No one's horrible.
Graham's just got hang-ups.
You know, no one is a horrible character.
No, they've all got hang-ups. They're like, Graham's just got these little issues.
Yeah. You know, everyone is I think, sympathetically and generously drawn as characters and with nuances. And I really appreciated that. No one we've talked about the two books together, so I am automatically thinking about them. But it's not like Savage Season. There's no one character in The Pillow Friend who's just there to be.
Can you stop a card slamming board, you know? Savage Season?
Like,
they're not apples to apples.
No, they're not, but we read them at the same time. So, but you know what I mean? Like, even the minor characters in the
show. Yeah, everyone's well drawn. I agree. It's a beautiful piece of writing. What I'm trying to say is that it's a beautiful piece of literary and genre writing. It's really a sort of beautiful piece of writing that should have a bigger literary audience than just a genre audience.
I love it so much.
But it has been reissued a couple of times, so I can't complain too much.
No, so it's clearly available now, which is really good, because I would have been very sad to have found that it was no longer in print or something.
Yes, there are definitely an ebook version.
And definitely an ebook, so that's really good too. But yeah, so I'm just I was really full, and as I said, I was professionally disturbed by I could see how
much basically perfection steals completely from this book.
No,
let's be honest, Perfections is a sort of sequel to this novel.
I think a
conceptual sequel.
I think what Perfections does, and as I said, it's so fascinating how little of this book I remember and how much it obviously influenced with Perfections.
I don't believe you at all,
because
now,
I think what I'm, and it's so, because it's a book I wrote, but now I'm, but obviously I'm having to reconstruct stuff because I don't remember The Pillow Friend. So I think part of what, because I know what I was, I know what I wanted to talk about with Perfections. I know what I was doing with the book. And I think a good part of that was talking to The Pillow Friend without knowing that's what I was doing, because there are, I think, like parallel sort of things that happen, but I take them in a different direction because I'm sort of, yeah, it's so weird. Like, I'm looking at this book going, this is clearly an ancestor to my book. This is so clearly an influence. Like, anyone who read The Pillow Friend and Perfections would go, oh, yeah, that's where McDermott was coming from. I have no memory of most of this book. It's so strange. But I love it because clearly it's sunk in there and burrowed away in my subconscious. And when I – and it's not just The Pillow Friend. I mean, there's a book by Nancy K. Holder called Making Love, that is again about creating a desirous being and things not going quite right, and it's not as though The Pillow Friend or All Making Love are complete outliers and no other book talks about this stuff. It's it's Pygmalion. It's like
Frankenstein.
It's all this stuff.
So I know
It's a thing.
But it just jumped off the page. That's all.
But the parallels are really fascinating, and it's kind of, I like the idea of The Pillow Friend like sitting there in my back brain, talking to my subconscious, and what comes out is Perfections.
On that note,
it's really cool. But I didn't rewrite The Pillow Friend. I'm not saying that.
No. Well, no, I am saying that.
I'm saying Perfections is clearly a book in conversation with The Pillow Friend, albeit subconsciously, which is even more fascinating than if I had.
And people should read Perfections.
Had
as
The
well.
Pillow Friend
as
sitting next to me when I was writing Perfections.
People should read Perfections as well, because so it's also weird. Fantastic. But let's not. You know.
No, let's not.
All right. Next episode.
First of all, before the next episode, we do have a new patron.
Oh, good.
So I would like to thank Louise.
Oh, thanks, Louise.
Thank you so much for being a patron on Patreon. We very much appreciate it, as we do all our lovely patrons. But yes, next episode, we thought.
I've forgotten. What are we doing next episode?
Next episode, being October, being the month of Halloween, we thought we'd talk about Shirley Jackson Award winners.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So we're looking at the anthology Eichmann's Heirs, which is edited
by. Is it Eichmann or Eichmann?
I've always said Eichmann.
Sounds slightly, you know, SS officer.
Oh, I'll say Eichmann now. I honestly, I've always said Eichmann, but I don't think I've ever heard anyone say it. So anyway, you say Eichmann, I say Eichmann. edited by Simon Strances, and that won the Best Anthology for the Shirley Jackson Award. And then we're also looking at the winner of the Best Novel, which is Experimental Film by Gemma Files.
That's right. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. I'm really looking. I've had that book on my to-be-read shelf.
You know, I've read it already.
I'm sure you have. Actually, I know you have because I saw your blog. I've bookmarked it. I haven't read your blog and haven't read the book yet, and I'll read your blog after I read the book. But anyway, so Eichmann's Heirs by edited by Simon Strances, so it's an anthology, lots of lovely short stories, I hope, and Experimental Film by Gemma Files.
My review on my blog is about 25 words, so I wouldn't be...
Oh, don't spoil...
No, I'm not spoiling.
Yes, so they're our books for next month, and I'm particularly looking forward to reading them, especially the Files, because I've heard a lot of good things about that. And as I said, it's been on my to-be-read shelf all year, and this was a great little impetus to say, let's make it a podcast book. So thank you all very much for listening, people. You can send us feedback by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, which is @writerandcritic. And also, if you can, we'd love it if you could sponsor us on Patreon.
That would be great.
And if you can't, we love that you listen to us anyway.
That's correct.
That's it.
I feel all talked out.
I do feel talked out.
Yeah. You should all read Savage Season, in spite of what Jason says.
You should all read The Pillow Friend.
That is true.
It's an awesome book.
You should definitely do that as well.
It's an awesome book.
Should you read Mandibles by Lionel Shriver? Bye.
Bye, everyone.
It's apparently a neoliberal conspiracy.